Welcome to the Inside CCW Safe Podcast with founders Stan Campbell and Mike Darter. If you're forced to fight the battle for your life, CCW Safe will fight the battle for your future.
Welcome back to the Inside CCW Safe Podcast. I'm Mike Darter in Oklahoma City.
I'm Stan Campbell, holding down the West Coast today.
And it's a little late for us.
It is late.
This is the first nighttime podcast that we've done.
Yeah, it is. So there is no weather report, because who cares? It's time for us to go to bed.
Because it's dark outside.
It's dark.
And nobody's out there. Oh, man, it's been hot here, man. I trained with Calvino today in one of the city park gyms with no AC. And it's probably the hottest day of the summer today for us. But it's been good. Looking forward to having you come out.
Yeah.
You're coming out, what, tomorrow or Thursday?
They'll be out Thursday.
So, nice.
Flying in for a few days, we can handle some business, get us some work done.
You know, we should start doing some meetups at some time. Like when you're in town, just have a deal. We have a meetup at Wilshire or whatever. Or when we're in LA, have a meetup and see what all three people would come.
Yeah, you know what? That's a good idea. That's a great idea, actually, because, you know, I know a lot of people that do that when they travel. And because we travel so much, maybe we need to start, you know.
Yeah, we could do one. And
putting it out there. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we may look at doing that. Would you want to do one while you're here, like Monday night?
Yeah. That
sounds good. We could do one that Monday, the, what is it, the 20, what would that be? I don't even know what today is.
It doesn't matter. But you know what? We're going to announce it. We're going to say on Monday, this coming Monday.
15th. Yeah, it'll be the 15th.
The 15th of July. We're going to have a CCW Safe meetup. So if you're in town, you want
in
to
Oklahoma
remember
this, City?
Come through.
We'll be at, we'll go hang out at Wilshire, have dinner there.
Yeah.
Have some drinks and have a good time.
I love it.
What you eating there, man?
A salad. I'm on a salad.
You're on a salad.
It's late night.
So tonight we're going to talk about just Stan and I. And we're going to talk about, you know, we talked about CCW Safe, kind of the history before, but it was like one of the first podcasts we did, right? It wasn't very good, quality. We'll be the first to admit quality sucked when we first started. but it's gotten better. We've got more... we've got more equipment. We're putting more into it. We're actually moving into a new office set right now for August 1st, but we're going to be actually building a dedicated podcast room. Mm-hmm. We'll probably have four mics. So when we have, you know, Larry in town or, some of our other people in town, we can do a podcast. We're going to probably be adding some video at some point. And so we're taking it serious. We want to, you know, do our best for our members.
Yeah. And please, everybody remember that, you know, we're really trying to give you some behind the scenes stuff with us. So we're not always going to be saying, you know, everything correct. And we might stutter. There might be a problem with the audio. I mean, it's not perfect. I mean, it's human stuff. So,
you might get some salad stuck in your teeth.
Shut up! I don't got no salad in my teeth. but you never know. But you know, in between the playing around that we do, I mean, we actually give some good information, and we actually got a email that I shared with you. Do you have that?
Yeah, we did get a good email.
It's a nice email from a member,
Brandon Thomas. And just wanted to, he said he wanted to pass on his appreciation for the podcast. He doesn't listen to music much anymore, but he's been listening to a lot of different podcasts. And he wanted to ask about traveling with firearms, whether it's flying or driving cross country. Mm-hmm. He just kind of had a request to maybe talk about that. And, you know, we travel a lot. So I do travel arm quite a bit. You know, it's pretty easy. I guess it's based on, you know, what cities you're going to or states. But, you know, it's also, and we know this from being in law enforcement, you know, it's also just a kind of a individual, you know, it depends on who you get as far as whether it be the airline people. You know, a lot of people, I mean, I've had pretty good luck. I haven't had any airline people give me any hassle. I haven't had any TSA people give me any hassle. You know, I've had one time where they requested me to come in and open it. But that was only one time. And I think that I can't even remember where that was. But, you know, if you have your, you know, a lock case and yeah. you have your ammo separate and you know, follow all the rules and have your paperwork done, it's really pretty easy to travel. I mean, it's a different story. Maybe if you're going to New Jersey or New York or California, yeah. but, you know, if you're going to, you know, I'm up in the upper Northwest quite a bit, Denver, all the way up to Seattle, you know, Wyoming, Montana, you know, it's, I've found it to be pretty easy.
It's just about on average with the major airlines, about a 10-minute process, maybe sometimes less. So maybe a 5 to 10 minute process on actually declaring your weapon. Cause that's what you have to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fill out their simple paperwork. Just like Mike said, you know, keep your ammo separate, you know, don't have any ammo inside of the firearm when you're doing it. Have
a lock, magazine.
Yeah, the magazine has to be out, have a lockbox. I mean, we can actually kind of go over this a little bit further in the future, you know, on a breakdown with some TSA issues.
Yeah, and there are people, I mean, one of the biggest recommendations if you do travel, armed or if you're, you know, in business and you travel with a firearm on your person or in any kind of bag, whether it be a messenger bag or whatever, if you have magazines, if you have, you know, spare magazines in those, the biggest thing is always like double check your carry on. because a lot of people, you know, say carry a messenger bag or a backpack and they'll have maybe a spare magazine in there and then they go through TSA and they forget about that.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
I've lost several knives.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. I actually lost one. Well, we were together up at the we went to the Top of the Rock in New York.
That's right. That's right.
So, yeah, that would be one big thing. And then, you know, you always just really need to keep up with wherever you're going, the state laws, what the laws and regulations are. I usually go to NRAILA.org, which is the NRA Institute of Legislative Action, and they have great info. Concealed Carry is another good one, mm-hmm. another good site that you can go to and get information on state-specific. I think they have a new app that you can actually get. Legal Heat is a great app. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to be traveling armed, always check that. And, you know, traveling, in a vehicle, if I'm in a vehicle, I'm traveling armed, I usually have it on me. So you just really have to know kind of what the declaration is in that state if you get pulled over. But really, you know, it's pretty easy. I've found it to be pretty easy. I don't, you know, as long as you just do what you're supposed to do, you know, I never have really had any problems.
Yeah, you know, and we've heard some really scary stories about people flying and then not even going. You know, their destination wasn't New York, but their plane got rerouted to New York, and when they landed, they caught a felony charge. So, I mean, you got to be mindful of that. And then don't forget, you know, CCW Safe although we do a lot of things and we have a lot of coverage, it has to follow a self-defense incident. So if you have an incident with the TSA or something like that, with traveling in your firearm situation, going past the security, as a courtesy, we'll get you an attorney, but that has nothing to do with a use of force. So it wouldn't fall under your coverage. So instead of getting in trouble.
We make recommendations all the time for that.
Yeah, we'll definitely do that as a courtesy, but I mean, it's happened to a few members. So we want you guys to, rather than do that, do the double check that Mike's talking about.
Yeah, that would be the biggest thing with travel. Just you know, I mean, you always have to, if you are carrying armed, you know, it is a responsibility, and you just have to take that time to check everything, make sure you got everything, your paperwork, and just follow the rules. But Brandon, thank you for the shout out, for the email, and for the your appreciation of what we're doing. We do put out, you know, some good information. Like Sean and Don, you know, the articles that they put out. I mean, really, those articles, Stan, I have to say, those articles are like, I think, some of the best information out there, because they're actually live cases, they're real cases.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot of people that, I mean, there's a lot of people that have that are in prison now, you know, for the rest of their lives, where if they could have just changed one, you know, decision or changed one action, you know, they may not be there. So those things are valuable.
Yeah.
So what we were going to talk about, just kind of go back over the history. What were you wanting to?
Yeah, I really do, you know, because we've had thousands of members join since we've done our first podcast. So
yeah.
I mean,
oh, before we go there, let everybody know about next week's podcast.
Well, go ahead.
You go ahead, man. You talk to him today.
Yeah, I did. So next week, you know, because we get a lot of calls on, you know, will you guys cover us if I was involved in a shooting incident with a active shooter, you know, into a school or whatever, a movie theater. So we have plenty of friends that are, you know, experts in the field, and we have a couple of friends from Oklahoma City Police that were on a SWAT team with me, and they've been teaching this for the past couple of years, you know. But actually they've also, you know, seen it evolve, you know, just like we have, and talk about the training for what police do, the response, and also what citizens do. So we're going to go over that and kind of, you know, give you guys some insight as to what the experts say to do. And then we'll kind of, you know, we'll chime in as well. And, you know, through our experience, kind of tell you guys what to do as well. But it's going to be a great show. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. And those two guys are studs. I mean, they're guys who, I mean, they're the top of the top.
They really are. Top great guys. Instructor. Steve Johnson and Blake Webster, shout out.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out. Blake is lieutenant now for Oklahoma City Police, and Steve is a sergeant.
Blake's been what? He's been the, doesn't he have the longest standing on the TAC team ever, or is that, or close to?
I think he could be the, I mean, because I'm sure he's at least 30 plus years, I think, on the SWAT.
Yeah.
It's been a long time. So, I mean, he's very knowledgeable. He's one of my favorite instructors, too, you know. I'm an instructor, and so are you. But I love to listen to certain people. And, you know, his demeanor, his knowledge, and the way that he, you know, explains, you know, complex, you know, situations, you know, he's just awesome. So I'm looking forward to it.
And they're really both guys that, you know, you'll be able to tell when they get on the podcast. They're both guys who you can immediately tell they know their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be good to have them on.
I agree.
So back to
the history of CCW Safe. always got to, you know, Mike has a lot of brilliant ideas, but this was the one. This was the one. You know, he and I both were coming up on retirement, you know, back 2011, 2012, 2010, really, we started thinking about it. And I retired in 2012. You retired officially when, Mike?
2011.
2011, okay. So a year before that, 2010, this man had a brilliant idea.
Yeah, it was.
He saw that there was a void in the industry because, you know, the thing that was special about it was the fact that policemen, if you think about the shootings that policemen are involved in, you know, they're looked at as a victim of a violent encounter. And citizens many times are looked at as suspects. So when you leave the police department in that umbrella of safety or comfort, you tend to try to find something that's out there that's going to match what you have. And Mike identified that there wasn't. So talk about that for a second.
Yeah, there wasn't. I got a funny story about talking about retiring. You know, Bill Booth is a good friend of ours, and he's an awesome guy. He's had a lot of he was a firearms instructor for the police department. He's been in on the advertising side of firearms as well after he left the department. But he told me one time, this is actually pretty funny, he told me that he went to his retirement party, and, you know, he pulled up to the police department, parked, and went in, and, you know, they had a big celebration. He got all these plaques, and it was like, you know, you served 30 plus years in the department, and this, you know, you had cake and coffee, and you got to see everybody. And, you know, you leave that when you walk out those doors, you're a civilian now.
That's right.
And you walk out, and there's a freaking parking ticket on your car. And that's retirement.
That's retirement.
The retirement of a police officer. And, you know, when I, we actually started looking at it, Travis Cerna and I, Travis, another great instructor. He's one of my favorite instructors on the mats, and he's a black belt in judo. He's a black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. He's, see a firearms. He's a firearms.
He's a firearms instructor too. Yeah.
And he was tag team.
Yeah. He was on the sniper squad with me as well.
Yeah. And he's a trainer at the police department. And, we were actually doing some training at the time. So at this time, I had a judo school for 20 years in Oklahoma City. When I was a police officer back when I had about 8 to 10 years on, I started a judo police team, and we went to the World Police and Fire Games, the International Law Enforcement Games, and so forth. We competed in judo, and it was awesome. We competed against you know, guys from Kazakhstan and Russia, and at the World Police and Fire Games. I mean, there were, you know, I think the year I went in, when it was in Indianapolis, and that was probably around 94, maybe something like that. I believe judo had the most nations competing out of any sport. Mm-hmm. It was huge. It was awesome. But we put together this team, and I had about 10 guys, and most of them got to black belt over the years. formed a nonprofit, and then we had a judo school, and we taught kids and adults, and kind of turned into this Oklahoma City Defensive Tactics judo training center. And so we had that, and we were doing some classes, and we thought, you know, we're like, hey, we need to start doing some classes kind of more geared toward concealed carry, but for hands-on, you know, how to, you know, maintain your firearm, how to keep your firearm against attacks. And we started talking, and I said, you know, yeah, we ought to find a company that might want to do some sponsor, you know, maybe some training that would be some kind of, you know, legal service to protect you if you're involved in a shooting.
Yeah.
Because I'd been involved in a shooting on the department, then I got sued in federal court over that, which we'll probably get into later. But So I called, you know, I just kind of looked around and I called Kyle Sweet, who is our general counsel. He is my stepbrother, and we've known each other since we were, you know, first grade. Great guy, great attorney, handles, you know, catastrophic, you know, these multi-million dollar cases. And I said, hey, you know, I was looking for a company to do this, and I haven't really found a whole lot. Do you know of any companies that do this? And he said, that's interesting. I need to, you know, that's something that he'd be interested in, because he was a former police officer as well. Yeah. Before we went to law school. And he called me just several days later and said, hey man, there's nothing out there. I mean, there's insurance companies out there, but you know, insurance, you don't want to have an insurance company covering you because of the insurance laws. And he saw that, you know, back in 2010,
writing on the wall.
2011.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing today, you know, play out in New York and some other places. And so he said, we need to do this. And, you know, we got together and talked, and then I talked to Stan, and yeah, I remember you saying, hey,
Shut it down. Stop
everything. Because at the time, you know, I was leaving ATF. I was did 10 years Oklahoma City and then 10 years ATF, and I was leaving, and I was kind of trying to decide what I wanted to do. You know, I was like, okay, am I going to continue, you know, doing judo? At the time, I was running, you know, team tournaments and tournaments here in Oklahoma, and had a lot of, you know, Dallas judo, had some close friends down there, because I lived down there for several years, and they were really awesome. I actually liked Texas judo a lot more than I liked Oklahoma judo as far as the politics. But
yeah, we had a website business going on, and a couple other things, and it was like, stop and kill everything else. That's the idea.
So we ran with it, and here we are today. You know, what are we at? 7 years later.
And, 7 years later, and we're number one in the industry, which we're very proud about.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing about it, too, you know, when you think about, you know, where we started, and, you know, it all comes down to not just a great idea. Great ideas are, everyone has them. It's, you know, knowing how to follow through, leaning on your expertise. And that was the difference between us and anyone else that's out there doing it, is that, you know, we come from thousands and thousands of crime scenes work and hundreds of shootings work. And then, you know, also, you know, many of us have been involved in shootings. We've been shot at. And then you've been involved in a shooting where you were forced to take someone's life, and you got sued for it. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, you have walked in the shoes of the member that's unfortunate enough to be involved in something like that. Mm-hmm. So it gives us a different mindset and a different, you know, respect for what you have to go through out there. And, but speaking of that, Mike, you know, because this is a new audience, why don't you take us back to that time of your shooting, if you don't mind?
Yeah. Well, before I talk about that, I wanted to say one of the things you were talking about, you know, being, you know, walking in those shoes and being, having that experience of actually being in a shooting and being sued in federal court. And it was kicked out at summary judgment, but it still took a long time to get there. And it would have been, you know, probably, over $100,000, possibly $200,000, I would think, to defend that, you know. And luckily I was a FOP member. But, you know, we talked about these different, you know, we're both kind of on the verge of retiring. And, you know, I've talked to some different entrepreneur groups and business groups about this thing. And you know, finding something to do with yourself, with your life, you know, a lot of times what is best for us may be right in front of us, mm-hmm. and you don't see it. And I always thought that what I did after my law enforcement career would be something with judo or martial arts or something. And a lot of them also may be negative experiences. And, I've talked to groups about, you know, don't look for just what you think what abilities you have, look at all the abilities you have. And even those things that are negative or those things that may be painful, painful time that you have gone through or whatever, you know, sometimes it's what's right in front of us. And those negative experiences can become the best positive experiences later. And that's something that I experienced with, with the Stephen Maddox shooting, mm-hmm. which I'll try to talk about later. But basically it was, you know, that I always thought that this company itself was the positive that came out of my shooting. Mm-hmm. But after the Maddox case, it was really that one case was the positive that came out of my shooting, because there was a lot of things that, you know, a lot of people probably don't know about, but the experience between Maddox and myself, finally meeting him, and the you know, we had some times that we shared that, you know, it was very close to both of us. Yeah. And, you know, I would like to say that I hope that would be the only case that, you know, and I hope that we don't have another case like that, just because I don't want anybody to have to go through that. But, you know, we may. But that was a really big kind of eye opener for me when I flew back from, you know, after we won that case and after we went out, we sat down and met him and did some video work. I came back just totally, it was crazy. I mean, totally recharged, totally on fire about this company again. Not that I wasn't, but, you know, you build something up and, you know, building a company is fun. That's the fun part of it. And then a company, if it takes off, then it becomes, basically it becomes work. And it's fun, but it's never like building that thing, you know. And after that case, I got that same experience of building this all over again.
Yeah.
And,
you know, and the thing about that, just to piggyback your thought, Michael, you know, you don't really, I mean, because I felt the same way. Of course, my parallel is a little bit different than yours with Maddox. But, you know, when you think about building the company, and you're absolutely right, it was fun. Everyone else at that time, and we're talking about 2015, you know, we were 2 years in. But everyone else at that time, prior to Maddox shooting, it was really just theory. You know, no one had worked a case all the way through. Now, we've been involved in cases like that, of course, in our jobs. But for our company, it was the first one that went all the way to a murder trial. Mm-hmm. And that was the significance of it, is that all those other companies are competitors. And still to this date, no one else has done a full murder trial on one of their members. Now, we all had deadly force shooting incidents that we've gotten ahead of, not to say that they haven't done anything, but we're the only ones that can say that we had the worst case scenario and we made it through it successfully. And that's due to our experience and helping to stay in there to manage the case. Because, these are not the type of cases that you can just throw money at and think that it's going to go away. I mean, you have to have the smarts, because you're going up against, you know, some real strong minds when it comes down to the DA's office. Mm-hmm. And we work with those folks. So we know they have a lot of money and they have a lot of big brains, and you have to match that.
Yeah. And sometimes it's just the little things that you know, one of the littlest things we did in the Maddox case that ended up being one of the biggest things we did was a simple thing of having lunch catered in every day for the legal team and for Maddox and for all the, you know, everybody involved, because we knew, and I remember, you know, when I was thinking about that, I was like, you know, we need to be able to, we need to have every day, we need to have lunch ready for them 30 minutes before they break so they can get in there and, you know, have lunch, not have to worry about that.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest things, you know, they were strategizing a lot in those lunches. And if they would have had to go somewhere to get lunch for, you know, 10 people or more, they wouldn't have had the time to do that. And they got a lot of, you know, positive ideas and a lot of good work done in that time. And, you know, I don't think a lot of companies without having the background, I mean, we've testified, you and I have both testified, I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of times on cases. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've been there and we know that, you know, you're not going to get a lot of time for lunch, and, you know, you may have to meet with the attorneys, with the DA, whatever, or on our case, the DA, but, your defense team. And, so that was something that even the little things, you know, some of the little things that we did in that case ended up being huge.
Oh, absolutely.
And then, I was just going to say the second case we had, you know, it didn't go to a trial, but in that case, you know, our response is one of the only, well, I think we are the only company that has a dedicated response like we have. And in the second major shooting case we've had, you know, we were the only. Our member was a member of three different companies, and we were the only ones that responded.
Yeah.
Initially, you know, 5 days later, he got a response by two of the others, but, you know, we already had it wrapped up by then.
Yeah, so. And what's significant about that particular case is that it was on Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And so it was a holiday shooting, and, you know, we were able to wrap it up, but it was only because we understood the importance of getting boots on the ground and, you know, having an investigator there to look at, you know, objectively look at the crime scene, you know, after it's been, you know, the investigators already had, you know, gone away. And, we actually had an attorney that had worked before with the homicide detective and the DA.
Yeah.
So I mean, we really got ahead of that one. We're sitting on another one, a deadly force incident that happened 3 years ago, and we're still, you know, just fighting against any charges being brought on by that one. Mm-hmm. But the last one was wrapped up really fast.
Yeah,
and we're talking fast for us is what, 4 to 5 weeks. It was probably 5 weeks when we got a decision and no charges filed.
Yeah, but we pretty much had everything wrapped up in 4 days.
Oh yeah,
had to wait
for I'm talking about waiting on decision. Yeah.
Decision from, and that's how it happens. And we'll go through my shooting, and we'll kind of talk about the stages and so people can kind of get an idea of what, you know, what would, if they were ever to be involved in a shooting, kind of what the stages would be. But, on my shoot, what do you want me to talk about?
I want you to really talk about, well, start off with the unit that you were in, because we both were in specialized units that that give you more of opportunity to, you know, be involved in, you know, those type of incidents. But talk about your training and then go into your incident, because the training has a lot to do with it.
Yeah, training has a lot to do with it. So I started the police department in 1991. Stan and I went through the same academy class. We both got out. We worked the streets. And I worked for about 4 years on the street. I was midnights the whole time. So I was working 9:30 at night, 7:30 in the morning. And I then went, after 4 years, went into a specialized unit that Stan, so it was called the Impact Unit, which was implementing multiple police actions against criminal targets. And that was, they had, we had four, the Oklahoma City is basically split into four quadrants. And so we had four briefing stations at that time. Yeah. And then we had our headquarters. And so I was working on the east side of Oklahoma City. Stan was working on the west side of Oklahoma City, northwest, northeast. And he was on the northwest team after I was on the northeast team, but we were both in these units, and these units were a plainclothes unit, and you could kind of do whatever you wanted to, as far as it was targeted at street level narcotics, street level felony crimes, you know, that, you know, if we didn't have anything to do, you know, you could kind of do your own surveillance. You could go out and work, you know, kind of what you ever wanted to. It was pretty easy to drive around certain areas and be able to be approached to buy drugs. So that was a lot of the times. If it was, you know, during the holidays, we'd hang out at the mall, kind of, you know, looking for things. We set up on businesses, you know, that got hit a lot during, once November came, for robberies and robbery season. And I mean, it was just awesome, because
robbery season is like the day after Halloween all the way into the 2nd of January.
That's right. And, you know, if something on homicide, there were times where we had homicides, they needed, you know, surveillance done or something. So it was a pretty cool unit to work, and it was plain clothes. So you kind of got to, it was fun. But anyways, so at the time when I first went into Impact, they were running the majority of the drug raids in Oklahoma City. They were running. And for those of you who don't know, Oklahoma City is a crossroads of America. The drugs come north and east, and the money goes south and west. And so we had a lot of, you know, we had a lot of, from LA to Memphis, we had all kinds of you know, street gangs coming in, from Chicago down to Mexico. We had, you know, we had all the folk and people nation from, you know, Chicago area coming down. We had all
the cartel
coming north. We had all the California gangs. I remember dealing with California Kitchen Crips. We had, you know, all the 107 Hoovers, all the blood gangs. I mean, they were all coming out. We worked cases with, you know, I remember working a pretty big case with the Secret Service on counterfeiting ring that was coming from LA to Memphis. And I mean, so we had a lot of stuff. People think Oklahoma City, you know, Oklahoma City had a lot of stuff moving through it. A lot of drugs, a lot of gangs. And so at the time, when I started Impact was running most of the drug warrants in Oklahoma City, if not all of them. And so the training on the Impact teams, I remember actually when I first went into Impact, I saw they'd show them on the news, you know, they'd show the news, the warrants, and some of them look like the Three Stooges. I mean, it's like they slammed the door and two guys were trying to make entry in the house and they get stuck in the door. Yeah. I mean, it was not great. So,
no, you know, the worst one, like I remember my first one as a troop going on before I was on Impact in 90, I think 90, 2004. That's when I went on my first one. The slam guy, as soon as the door from the van opened up, the slam guy, he run faster than anybody else, and I was second. So it was like a race to the door, and he slammed the door and let the slam go in, and then he went in as number one. It was terrible.
It was terrible. I remember on the east side one time hitting a house, and the slam went through the door.
Oh, God.
Like all the way through the door, and we were like looking through this hole in the door, like, what do we do now? Because it was like a hollow door in there.
All right, Mike, I think you're trying to be slick. You're not going to get out this story. I need you to get
back. No, I'm back on. So anyway, well, I was getting on the training, man. Come on. So they started with the guy that was in Impact got shot one night, Bo Leach, great officer. He went on to do, went to federal level. Mm-hmm. He was shot one night, and it really kind of started to change, I think, at that point. But it was a little bit even later than that when I worked on the east side with Lieutenant Bybee, that he really started taking the training more serious. And he had, you know, a lot of his friends were guys, big guys on the TAC team, yeah. Sipe and Bear and those guys. And so we started going out to train with the TAC team. And it started with Spring Lake Impact. Mm-hmm. And so we would go out and we would train. And so we were doing live fire entries. We were doing, or we built up to that. You know, we were doing a lot of pretty high level training. And so, you know, I was at the height of my training on our shooting. Mike Kelly was my partner, and he and I were, you know, we were the two probably that spent more time at the range. You know, we had a pretty good unit. Everybody was pretty serious. Everybody trained. Mm-hmm. But Mike and I probably shot more than most people. We trained, you know, in judo and aikido. Mm-hmm. So we were always number one and two. Mike was, you know, shorter than I was, so he was number one. I was number two. What are you laughing at, man?
Just the short guys being number one is funny.
I can shoot over them.
Yeah.
So, you know, we get into this house, and it's a guy just got out of prison. He was a white supremacist gang member in prison, got out dealing drugs. You know, he and his dad lived together. His dad was in it, and long story short, we got a buyout of the house. We knew there was a gun in the house. You know, he had bragged about shooting two black guys who pulled a home invasion on his house. And, you know, we checked everything that we could. You know, we checked hospitals, checked 911 calls, checked everything, and nothing. We had nothing to make us think that he had actually done that.
Yeah.
But the problem was that he now had that in his mind, and if we go to kick in his door, and the, you know, the CI saw a large firearm, we, you know, had a pretty good idea probably what was going to happen. And so at first they wouldn't let us. We kicked it to the TAC team because the TAC team was, you know, for high risk, high profile, you know, warrants, and they actually declined. Mm. They said it was too high risk. So we kind of sat on it for a couple of days. And we're like, look, we can't, I mean, this isn't right. I mean, we have to hit this house.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to, you know?
This ain't right.
This ain't right. And our lieutenant, he said, put it on the board, which means, you know, draw it up. And, you know, we would on the, the teams would always have, and it'd usually be different people than the, like my partner and I were the actually ones who had the CI that got to the house. And then there would usually be different people on the team that would go do surveillance on the house, and based on windows and doors and vents and pipes, you can usually tell what, you know, the layout. So we'd draw a layout, get as close as we could and put it on the board. And that means it's we're putting it on the board and we go over our plan and then we go on the warrant. And so we did that. And of course, as soon as we entered the house, the suspect was on the couch, rolled up with the firearm, pointing it toward me. And as I saw it coming up toward me, I saw a big muzzle flash, which I thought was the bad guy's gun. And I thought Mike was number one. He was already in. Mm. I thought bad guy shot. I thought Mike got hit because I tunnel visioned in, super focused on the guy's hand. In fact, my first shot, and I could see it actually in like slow motion kind of going in. I didn't see the spin. A lot of officers talk about seeing the actual spin of the bullet. I didn't see that. But I did see the entry wounds kind of in slow motion open, and that was what I was going off of. And as he was rolling up, my first round hit the back of his hand, and his gun cut. He was laying on the couch. His gun fell on his stomach, and he started reaching for it. And I just kind of used those entry wounds as my – source of, they were basically my sights. Cause weren't using your sights at all at that point. I thought Mike got hit, I shot 7 rounds in probably just over a second. I glanced over and saw Mike was still up. Actually his firearm had stovepipe. So he was clearing his gun. And at that time, I, brought my attention back to the suspect on the couch. I knew he was gone at that point, just from visuals. Yeah. And then at that time, I heard more shots. Yeah. And what happened was Dad came out, got Mike, grabbed around the neck, grabbed his gun, tried to pull him back in the hallway. And I didn't know that. So I was like freaking out at that time, because, I heard he fired one shot, but I heard like 5 shots.
Yeah.
So I experienced tunnel vision. I experienced auditory exclusion because I didn't hear any of my shots. I didn't even hear the first shot. I just remember seeing this big muzzle flash. After that last shot, he's coming running toward me. We run out. We go to the corner. I reload. I dump one round on the corner of the house, reload. I'm yelling, everybody, get the back, get the corner. Everybody, lock down this house. And then we actually went back in, which, we found out later in the lawsuit that probably wasn't the best idea for us to do, but we had to go in and clear the house. I remember seeing Dad walk out and collapse on the front porch. I was like, who the hell is that? And Mike said that's who had me, who came from behind. And we entered the house, cleared it again. I had caught like my kind of raked my shin down the porch, I think, when I was coming out of the house or going back in. I don't even remember. So my leg was cut. I ended up going to the hospital, went to homicide and did the interviews. And so that was pretty much my shooting. In my case, did my initial interviews immediately. There wasn't the 24-48 hour rule that they use now back then. However, I was allowed to go back in about a week later and look at the reports.
What was that, 97?
That was in 96.
96, okay.
It was almost 1 year to the date after the bombing.
That's
it was
right.
Like April 6th. So, so, went back in. I was off. We were off for 3 months, just because one guy kind of on the major on the department kind of had a weird feeling. This is not, this is not, this needs to be looked at. There were some little things that ended up being just kind of silly that they didn't, nobody really ever contacted us when we were out. And keep in mind, I got married 1 month exactly to the day after my shooting.
Wow.
So, I come back from my honeymoon and I call my partner. Hey, have you heard anything? No, I haven't heard anything. We eventually do go back to work. I stayed in the unit for a short time after that and then ended up going to the gang unit. And while I was in the gang unit, I got sued in federal court. Mm-hmm. The ex-wife all but thanked us when it happened, telling us the guys was, worthless. I think they broke into the house after we released it, stole all his shit, and then, 2 years later filed on us as for a wrongful death. And so that was kind of the experience that I had. And I know we're about to running out of time, and this might be something that we want to come back and talk about the post separately, because there was a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I really think you should, because it's important to, and we don't do this enough. We have Maddox do it every once in a while, but it's important to hear from someone, what happened to them during, really before, during, and after the shooting.
Yeah, because there's a lot of things that, and I'll just kind of, what we'll do is we'll go up to the investigation post. But I remember when I came out of that house, I remember just thinking like, when we went back in, Mike and I went, we ended up in the kitchen. It actually is kind of a funny story. We end up in the kitchen and we're both have our guns on the, pointed at the oven.
Yeah.
And we're sitting there and we look at each other and we're like, holy shit.
Yeah.
What just happened?
Yeah.
And we turn around and there's a door behind us that goes out into the garage. Well, the garage was a converted bedroom.
Oh, man.
So we look, we turn around, we're like, holy shit, we got this door behind us. So we actually, everybody else is clearing the rest of the house. So we go into that door and open the door, pie around, we're pying around looking corners. Everything's clear, but the wall goes straight out from the door. Mm-hmm. And then there's a bed that goes around the wall. So we didn't know really what was around the wall, if it was actually an open space, like a closet, or if it was actually just a wall.
Yeah.
But we had a feeling that it kind of went back in there. So we were we cleared everything else. I was holding on that corner, and I remember we said, okay, we're going to go around this corner on three.
Yeah.
And, I think Kelly went low, I went high, and, we put our knee on the bed to go around this corner. It's a freaking waterbed. So we start rolling. We start rolling across the bed, and it is a closet there, luckily nobody was in there, but we're rolling across the bed and I'm thinking this is a freaking haunted fun house at the, the state fair. It's like, get me out of here, man. It's like them clown like to pop Twilight out. Zone. Oh man. It was like,
no. You know what I want to know before we exit. Why were y'all pointing your guns at the oven? What was it? What was in the oven that you didn't
like? Dude, we were freaking out. I mean, we go back in, we pass the guy. I passed the guy that I just shot. He's on the couch. We had to step over Dad, who's dead on the front porch.
Yeah.
We go back in the house.
Yeah.
And, we go to this room, and it's clear we're in the kitchen. And, we're just both, kind of shell shot. We're like, what the fuck? What just happened?
Yeah.
And that's one of the things, that I think, getting into when we talked about, next week, we can, What we'll do is we'll go ahead and do the interview with Blake and Steve, but what we'll do is we'll follow this one up with part two, and then we'll put them on not next week, but the week after.
Yeah.
And when I went through the expert witness, I learned so much. That expert witness, Chuck Higbee from LAPD, he was our expert witness. And I learned that was the best class I ever attended as a police officer. You know, we went to a lot of classes. You went to a lot of classes. I went to a lot of classes, some awesome classes in the, over our years. We had drug training and went to homicide classes, went to, you know, shooting reconstruction classes. This was by far just the few days I had with Chuck Higbee. It was amazing. He was one of the chosen frozen from Choson Reservoir. Amazing guy. He investigated, I don't know how many tens of thousands of shootings in LA, but we'll come to that next week.
Yeah.
And there is a lot, you know, I haven't talked like this about my shooting in a long time. And there is a lot of things, little lessons.
Takeaways.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, before you leave, and we're about to wrap this up, but you know, I talk to people all the time, and I say that you know taking a life, taking another human life is just not natural. It's not a natural thing to do.
No.
And I say when you do so, you actually enter into a relationship with the deceased because you never forget them. I mean, is that true?
You know, it's funny. It's funny you say that because my dad was a Methodist minister, and I have a brother that was a police officer. I have a stepbrother that was a police officer. And one day we were driving down to like FedEx. I had to go down and pick up a package or something. My dad came by, so he went with me. And, you know, this is, you know, not too soon after my shooting. And I was driving, and I remember I was telling him, I was like, oh, man, we got in a pursuit right here. And they bailed out. We chased this guy down through these backyards, and there was a dog and all stuff. And then, you know, oh, man, we got in a fight up here on this porch. We're passing all these, you know, the FedEx locations on southwest kind of part of town. There's a lot of Hispanic gangs down there. And then we passed the street of my shooting, and I was like, oh, man. I was like, Dad, my shooting was just right down that street. And my dad asked me, he said, man, I was wondering, he goes, do you ever think about those guys? And I said, every day.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it's not like, it's not something that I told him. I said, you know, I wouldn't do anything different.
Yeah.
You know, I would have done the same thing, but it's just something that, it's just kind of a part of you, and not good or not bad, but it's just something that, I mean, it's an experience, you know. You never forget. It's like being involved in any other critical incident, you know. People who've been involved in like major car wrecks, it's kind of a part of them, you know. I mean, it's kind of like that. But yeah, it's a weird, kind of a weird, weird feeling. So
yeah. Well, you know, we're going to continue this, you know, next week. So we'll finish this out because, you know, I mean, it's a lot of important stuff that, you know, I really want the listeners to hear.
Yeah,
we
can talk about, we'll talk about picking up with the homicide interview and then going forward to the lawsuit. So
absolutely. Sounds great.
All right, man. Good to talk to you.
All right, brother. Have a good night.
Be safe out there.
All right. Bye, guys.